Hi there, my name's Ollie Lloyd and welcome to the Food Talk Show. On today's show, we're joined by Robert Thompson, MBE, one of Britain's top chefs. Robert is one of the first chefs, one of the youngest chefs actually, to be awarded a Michelin star and was one of the first chefs who joined Great British Chefs back in 2011. So let me start by welcoming Robert to the Food Talk Show.
Hey there, thanks very much for inviting me on.
Well, it's great to see you again, Robert. It's been too long. So let me start by asking, I suppose, how did you start this illustrious career of yours in the world of food? What got you into food in the early days?
In short, I've loved it. 10 years old, my little project at school was a restaurant. It was actually a restaurant over about four floors, but it was a restaurant-type operation. Right from early age, 10 years old, I've always wanted to be a chef.
Hang on, what do you mean, at 10 years old, what were you building? It was your sort of project, like a little...
At 10 years old, I had some project at home, I remember it. I designed a club with stalls and all, how it was going to work and how I was going to make my millions, basically. So that was in the kind of same time as cooking in the kitchen. I did a lot of cooking at home with my parents. They were very much kind of, everything was made, all made fresh. Not kind of extravagant or anything like that, but that's kind of where it all started, I guess.
Amazing. And then where did you begin your professional career?
So my brother Patrick, Roux Scholar, back in 98, he was 7 years older. So fortunately I had a very, very early insight into a professional kitchen. 13, I was already in the kitchen, legally or not, washing up. Very quickly moved on to the dessert section. Back in the day it was brandy snap baskets with chantilly and a little feathering of a coulis and whatnot. and that's how I got into it.
Amazing. And look, I suppose you are touted as one of the youngest chefs ever to win a Michelin star. Tell me about that and how that happened.
I was working for Patrick, my brother, working up in near Doncaster, a great place called Chimneys. I suppose I wanted to spread my wings. I'd been there about 16, 18 months. I wanted to get back into the Michelin game. Quite close to me was Wintering and Fields, 2 Michelin star, 9 out of 10, 5 out of 5, everything basically. Jermaine and Annie Schwab. So got in the car with Patrick, we went over there, I had an interview, still remember it today, very scared almost, sat there talking to Annie. Had an interview there. Launched into it as an apprentice, they took me on as, I think it was 3 years later I was a head chef. Jermaine was just one of those chefs. He was in the kitchen at 7 in the morning. He was there at 1 o'clock at night. And I owed him a huge amount. They really just propelled me, gave me every single bit of help and support I needed. And I guess I was just charging forward. I just charged because I just wanted to, go for it. And Jermaine was that person who really kind of gave me those breaks.
It's interesting, isn't it? I remember back in the day at Great British Chefs, we always talked about lineages and how, all great chefs kind of start somewhere. And Wintering Fields is one of those places that kind of is one of those sort of iconic restaurants that sort of, created a whole sort of bubble around it, didn't it?
It did. I mean, you can still remember walking through those corridors, the feel of the place and the kind of the... You felt you were on edge when you were working. And I don't mean in a bad way, you're not scared, but you felt the kind of the gravitas of the place. And Jermaine, just seeing him at the pass, he was just one of those, I used to call him a friendly giant, he was just such a great kind of person to show you, but also he let you kind of do your thing as well. He put, you'd get the hand around the back of a neck if something was going a bit wrong. And then Annie was highly serious, but so professional and fair. But something wasn't quite right. You saw a member of team step out of line and laziness. You didn't want to be him, really didn't.
But obviously you've sort of in some ways made your name though back in the Isle of Wight. So I speak to you as you are now in the Isle of Wight. I can see the trees blowing in the distance behind you. So what took you back to the Isle of Wight?
Not from here at all originally. I only had one memory going down a Shanklin China on my dad's shoulders. I was at Clifton. I moved out of Wintringham. It got sold. I stayed for a year with a new owner, but then I wanted to spread my wings. So via Clifton, been to the Isle of Wight. Basically, an agency friend said, how do you fancy it? And I said, yep, let's go and have a look. I got here, I drove down, I took one look at where I was been working, going to be working, and just the view, sea, and I just thought, you know what, this is something special here. Bit of a culinary backwater at that stage. This was, 16, 18 years ago. Huge amounts, I think, has changed in that time. But that's how I ended up here. No prior experience of it, to the point now where I wouldn't leave.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it was a culinary, I mean, to use your words, a culinary backwater. I mean, because you kind of, there are a number of people who probably put the Isle of Wight on the map, I suppose, from a sort of food perspective, and you're certainly one of them. I mean, what is it that makes the Isle of Wight special from a food perspective?
I suppose the fact that you're surrounded by water, you know, you've got a lot of kind of supplies, you know, supplies kind of like locked in this garden aisle, how it's known. Just from a growing sort of aspect, like Isle of Wight tomatoes, for example, being one, because you've almost got like this mirror kind of effect around from the water. So you've got the most sunshine hours anywhere in the UK. But it's not just that. You've got lots of, you know, fishing kind of boats coming in. You've got great pasture land. And then like lots of places, there's lots of those small artisan suppliers, you know, here or there. For me, it's more than that, though. It's not just about the produce and, you know, because there's lots of places across the UK that have that. For me, I just love it. I love the sea. I love the scenery. Walking, foraging is a huge part of, like, you know, not just for the restaurant, just generally enjoy doing it. So it's just got that charm about it. But I think if you're a kid and growing up here, lots of them will leave and kind of go off and do yachts and things like that. I think it's got this pull. It tends to pull people back when they're maybe a bit older, like 30s. Fantastic place to bring up children. So I think, yeah, there's a bit of a strange thing about it, just a bit of a hold on people.
And have you seen it? I mean, because, you know, the Isle of Wight tomatoes, who you mentioned, I suppose, are probably, you know, to most listeners, probably the brand that people know the most, because, you know, we see them in lots of kind of independent delis in and around the UK. You know, they're very much a brand that is sort of on the ascendancy. Are there, you know, is do you feel the food scene has changed a lot in the Isle of Wight in the last 16 years?
You can absolutely know, can you tell it is. It's changed so much to the point now where you'll get so many guests coming in, like when I was back at Wintringham and places like that, where people know about food so much more, you know, and they demand, you know, a lot higher standards. I think in general, the places that have cropped up here over the last few years as well, you've got some really, you know, for example, the Hut, you know, you've got a very well-known place there that draws people across the Solent in their absolute hundreds and hundreds every day. So I think the Isle of Wight's had a real spotlight on it for the past, you know, 20 years, I'd say.
But remind me, are you still the only Michelin star there? Is that right? Or is there...
So no star. I haven't had a star kind of at the moment. I'm just in the process of moving venues at the moment. But no, in terms of, there's no Michelin stars on the island. There are, I think there's probably two or three recommended places that are in the guide. But if we go back, you know, I had to start at Hanborough. That was when I first came here. But since then, I think prior to that, it was Kevin Mangiel was at the George. You know, going back quite a long time ago.
Wow.
Who had a star, I think it's about 9 or 10 years there. Great, yeah, guy who's got the Neptune up
the
in...
The Neptune up in Norfolk?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
So no, it's still, you know, sadly, a bit of a backwater in terms of the Michelin, the higher echelons of Michelin.
It's interesting, is it? Because you talk about how, you know, you sort of said it's changed a lot. I mean, what do you think people's expectation of food has changed in those periods? I mean, what do you think when people walk into a restaurant nowadays they're really looking for?
I think there's a lot of people who turn around and say, like, tasty menus are dead and all of that's gone, fine dining is finished. And I don't believe for a second it has, and I'll never believe that. I think there's always a space for it. For me, it comes down to, it's just got to be great food, whatever market, whether it's a pub or whether it's a cafe. I think the pressure is increasing more and more and more on that coffee being perfect, you know, because people see it on Instagram all the time of how, for example, how it looks when it comes to them, the biscuit that goes with it. But I think right across the board, the food has to be absolutely top-notch. The supermarkets are chasing your tails all the time with all their ranges and all sorts of things they're bringing out. So But also value. Value is another thing that I think is really kind of, you know, is changing. People seeing, maybe going out a bit less often. I've noticed that a lot in my guests, people maybe coming to me, let's say, 4 or 5 times a year instead of, you know, 8 or 10 times a year. But when they come, the spend I've seen has not gone down. If anything, the spend has gone up. And actually what you're paying for per glass, for example. But it's just less frequent. I think what people are saying is they would still want these great things, just do them a little bit less often, maybe. Hence why my current where I'm at, I'm now going, right, we need to offer food maybe on a slightly different level. Tasting menus and all these things are great, but they're not necessarily maybe the money makers.
Interesting. It's funny, actually. I mean, the whole question around, you know, doing special things, but doing really special things and doing them less often does feel like a trend that is really, really playing out. Mm. And I also think that the reality is that, you know, with the cost of living crisis we're going through at the moment, and, you know, I was in Liverpool the other day for work and ended up having the only culinary option was a Pizza Express. And the Pizza Express pizza cost £16. And you sort of go, wow, you know, actually, you know, when everything starts to cost that, you know, you do realise that people do have to kind of, you know, make choices, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, so I was at a pub yesterday. Family, you know, sort of deals at a pub. I mean, the starter was £8. £8. It was like a bayer bun type thing that someone had, I saw. And I looked over and I reckon there must have been like 4 tempura tiger prawns in these 2 or 3 bayer buns and everything else. And I looked and went, £8? Like, you know, for £8 now, what can you put on a plate? Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of something when you're using shellfish, it doesn't matter where you're buying it from. So I think as chefs, there was a point where we always used to be had to be clever with dishes. Jermaine taught me that very well. Your profit is in the bin. But now, I mean, you've got nowhere to hide, literally. I think you've got like your bin, but not just your staffing costs are through the roof. You could, yes, absolutely, staff should be earning great wages. But what has the price of a starter gone up by, the main course? A steak, for example, to put a good, great ribeye on the plate when that ribeye is costing you, what, a tenner? Just for the actual piece of meat. And then you're saying to someone, well, you need to charge 30 for that. And they can't believe it. You know, by the time you've added everything else, you're 40 a main course. Which, for example, here, you know, or out of a city, you know, on the island, that is kind of unheard of. Mm. Quite kind of tough times in that respect.
But it does force creativity, doesn't it? I mean, I think there is that challenge whereby, you know, it means you have to go for cheaper cuts. You have to think about making the processes work harder, because otherwise, actually, you don't get, you know, the kind of the out. You know, people just don't feel they can pay it, do they?
Yep. I think you say, being cleverer with ingredients is very important. But then, you know, Jermaine kind of forced that down us. You know, I was very kind of you know, eyes on him all the time, of looking how he came up with menus and what he put on the plate. So it's almost like we've been doing that for quite some time. I think I'm finding now go further than that and go staffing, for example. When staffing costs are so, so big, it's for me, it's working out how can I incentivize that staff member or give them something where they have ownership in the business and they feel like it's part theirs, because that's what the biggest killer for me is the wages. If you've got a team of people, for example, some who maybe don't want to be there, some who look at it's just a way of earning money, for example, you're going to need double. Mm-hmm. You're going to need so many more of them. I need people now, unfortunately, this is where it's got to. When people come through that door to work, you need 100% until they leave. There's no room to hide. They've got to like go for it. So why are they going to do that? And I think that's where I'm focusing my energies now in. Not just about minimum wage. It's not about that for me, because you get minimum wage, what can you do with it? It's just going on shopping or bills. It's more for me giving them a kind of a little look into the future and going, if we get this right and if we do well, I will share everything of me with you. I think that's the kind of a conclusion I've come to. Whether it's, you know, if I'm going off on a cruise, cooking on the cruise, that's going into the business, whether I'm doing whatever events, you know, cooking demos, whatever we're doing, UB Chef, for example, it's all going into the same pot. And I'm saying to them, like some key people, 4 or 5 of them, I'm saying, look, your soldiers, we're all together in this. It will live or die with us. But if we make it work and we make it go far, you're not just going to get a percent or whatever. You'll be able to retire from it. And that's where I'm at. That's the only way I think you can go forward with something where you want to achieve well and have really happy guests and an experience type dining.
And the truth is that you can tell it, can't you? You know, you walk into a restaurant, and if the people in that restaurant, when they greet you and when they talk about the dishes, when they're actually, you know, they're really part of, you know, that story. They know what's gone into things. They know where things come from. It makes a real difference to the customer. And we've all had experiences in very high-end restaurants where that happens, and in places where it doesn't happen. And, you know, I think it's a real challenge, isn't it, today, to get people to tell your story and to inspire guests to see, I suppose, the magic that's on the plate and to believe it all.
Yeah, that excitement of now, when you find a staff member, when you find someone comes through the door, a young person, and you see that glint in their eye and you can see that hospitality, they might not even know they've got it, but you can recognise it a mile off, whether they've got that bug and whether they love, you know, people and just the adrenaline that comes through of it. And if you do and you find that person, then you can go, okay, if I can land them, then I've been through all of the pitfalls of, along the way, and all the stuff that can happen through overworking, through not eating properly, through, you know, everything. And you can hopefully then share that knowledge with them a bit and steer them at the same time. I think that's for me, it's huge important part of the job now.
But the fact is, it is very satisfying, isn't it? Which is because every time, well, in most cases, when someone walks into your restaurant, they're there for a special reason, right? They're there to have an amazing meal. It's not repetitive for them. So for them, they've never maybe eaten this dish before. So if you can't make them feel like it's a special occasion, it knocks the stuffing out of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, you've got to get to them in all different ways. It can be the food, but it equally can be the drink. It could be just remembering, for example, their dietary requirement or something about them that you just go, no, all sorted. Didn't love a day at the restaurant. Lady came in, literally chicken. She just has chicken. But she was too scared to ask that time. She didn't ask. And I saw her in the bar, went over, and it was actually the final days of Thompson's at Newport. And I went over and I said, great to have you back in. And she looked at me and I could tell what she was thinking because she just had glanced at the menu. I went, don't worry. Got a lovely, you know, chicken on the crown. It's been brining, you know, hopefully we're going out of a bang. And she was nearly in tears. You know, that's the special part of this job.
It is, isn't it? So tell me, there's a lot of change going on in your restaurant empire. Tell me about the new restaurants and what's happening.
So took the decision to close Thompson's or work towards closing it. It's no point heading the sand. The last few years have changed lots and lots. Where it is, it's a town centre. It's not the ideal location. It never has been, but it was a foot in the door for me and it was a freehold property, so hence why I went for it. And it served me very well. But as you can see in the background, you know, where I am now, I'm about to take on, or have taken on, a large property on a really good lease for a good number of years. Most important thing about here is I can get what I've been after for so long, two dining concepts in one place. Not spreading myself between lots of restaurants and venues and, you know, across the Isle of Wight. So upstairs, we've got a fantastic area which just looks out over the Solent, uninterrupted views. The sea laps up to its seawall and crashes over when it's a bit rough. Really nice old Georgian building. Upstairs, I've got a cafe grill, which I'm putting in. So about 80 covers upstairs with a great bar area. You know, restaurant area with tablecloths, some high level seating as well. This is aimed at every day. You know, you could come in for breakfast, lunch, dinner, you could come in for a glass of wine in the afternoon, bring your laptop in the morning, Sunday paper. But also, it has a very almost the same size space downstairs where I've got kitchen and where later in the autumn I will have Thompson's. So I'll relaunch Thompson's later in the year. That for me then is really about refining. Up until this point, you know, like in Thompson's, it had to be a business. It very much had to be a business, and hence I'm open on Sundays, doing the Sunday lunches, and I'm, you know, all sorts of things that you have to get on with there, which I think can almost take your eye away and put the pressure on not so much the food, maybe. Here, I see that as different. Upstairs, I've got a what looks to be going to be a very, very busy, vibrant space, allowing me to, for example, just do a tasting menu only type operation downstairs, where I can really refine, go back over all of those dishes I've done over the many, many years, and I can put that on for the guests who want to come along and have a tasting menu experience. Yeah, write the whole thing, come down, meet the chefs, say hello. And there's lots of them because they come to Thompson's and do that. But upstairs will be my, I don't want to say cash cow because that makes it sound horrible, you know. But upstairs is my area which will have big throughput going through it. Downstairs is where I can say 30 covers, tasting menu, coming from the same kitchen. I've got one team doing all of it. And then I can, the worst thing would be having two teams where you've got like, you know, like the A team and the B team.
Yeah.
You know, not doing any of that. This is one team where we all kind of change in what we're doing and sharing it. And then we grow together.
But I'm assuming the menu upstairs is simpler, more kind of bistro style, sort
Absolutely.
Of more classic. So that's where you're doing your Sunday lunches. That's where you're doing your kind of classic pieces.
Yeah, I mean, even like, you know, just on the dessert, I mean, I can't wait to get Knickerbocker Glory on the dessert menu, you know, kind of just like a dish like that, you know. I could never put that on the menu at Thompson's. You're just not going to. But as a kid, you know, and going out of a family, I mean, if the kids are happy, you've won, haven't you? So things, dishes like that, but like a great kind of schnitzel, for example, or a great, just a great steak with some nice sides. So, yeah, the menu will be much more pared back up here. There'll always be some salads, pasta risotto, some appetizers, great little snacks as well, where you can just come in and sit at the bar with some cheese gougères, cuttlefish crackers, tiramisu, dishes which I've done for years. But then you could have a steak. Breakfast as well. You could come in the afternoon and get a great cake, for example. But so we're going to make it. And I want them to go, do you know what? That's the best slice of cake I've had. And it's in these surroundings where they're going to get a lovely tablecloth. They might be eating a burger, but, you know.
Well, Robert, I've been lucky enough to eat your food in lots of different settings over the years and cook many of your recipes. And one of the ones that, for me, has stood the test of time is a chocolate tart with chili in it.
Yeah.
So if I could make one recommendation, I think the chocolate chili tart remains an absolute classic that probably needs to be somewhere on the menu. But I'm assuming your idea is also to bring in, you know, there was always a sense of flair and creativity to your food. I remember the sort of smoke cloches that you lifted at one of our launch events. I remember the eel and pork puffs that you cooked actually at the day we launched Great British Chefs on Old Street Roundabout.
Yeah,
I'm assuming you're going to bring some of that kind of, you know, that sort of particular kind of Robert flair into the way you do things, even in the bistro.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't want to be confined to, for example, some of those dishes that you just mentioned then. You know, chocolate tart. For example, a chocolate tart with some zest of lime on the top, a hint of chili in the background, and just a little creme fraiche with it, for example. That dish up here, done well, just warm the tart up just a bit so it's just, the chocolate's really nice to eat. We'll go down a storm up here. But is it kind of enough, you know, these days for like a, you know, fine dining type operation, tasting menu? It's not. But does that mean I don't love that dish? No, it doesn't. I absolutely love that dish, but I want to serve that to a guest who maybe wants a bit of a simpler, you know, dessert on that occasion. And then when they next come downstairs, they're going to get this souffle coming, you know, whatever it might be. I'd like to impress and be remembered by, you know, on a, you know, weekly, monthly basis, whenever guests come in, for different levels. Not just fine dining with all of the smoke and cloches, and which is not just for effect. It's there, for example, with that lamb carpaccio, to give that lamb just that element, just as you're eating it. But still, you're not going to start doing up here if you've got 80-odd, 100 people, because you'd alienate most of them at the end of the day, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and look, I think the game in some ways is that, you know, I think we've seen this over the years very well from chefs, is that actually, sometimes you do want to dial things up and have that kind of special anniversary or, you know, special occasion dinner. But you also want to be able to have the classic kind of, you know, family lunch, you know, that's just really special and really lovely. And I do think, you know, increasingly, you know, people you know, I know I've taken my kids to a fair number of restaurants over the years, and they're very happy eating interesting things. So actually, you know, giving the kids a chance to try interesting stuff is really important, isn't it?
Mm, absolutely, absolutely.
Now, also, you know, if two new restaurants wasn't enough, you've also thrown a recipe box, or sort of, it's not a recipe box, it's a food box idea. Tell me more about that, where that idea came from, and what the plans are.
I suppose, summed up, let's just say it saved me. It completely saved my bacon. We all spent, you know, I don't want to go back to those days because it's done, it's happened. But you spent 2 or 3 days staring at the wall, wondering what on earth you're going to do. Then you, as I'm sure a lot of chefs did, you went back to the venue, you looked at your freezer and your fridge and your dry stores, and you went, right, let's make some stuff, which we did. The menu went just nuts straight away. When I was making it, I was driving around the Isle of Wight twice a week on a Friday and Saturday, at that stage of brown paper bags and Chinese containers, delivering meals. I wrote a menu on a Monday, Tuesday, I put it on Instagram, just did a lot of that. That very quickly ramped up. I had many, many requests, of course, get it to the mainland. I think by then you could see a number of other ones doing it. For example, Tommy Banks. I mean, that was just amazing watching the rate of and how quickly he got that out. Adam Handling, you know, lots of people. So it was a little bit more of an issue where we're on an island and we've got to kind of get it over. but anyway, we did all the testing with the temperature control boxes. I mean, weeks and weeks spent about cardboard, you know, thickness of cardboard and whatever else. But anyway, so UB Chef at that stage, just branded slightly differently, became very, very busy. It went past the revenue of what the restaurant was quite quickly. So when we could all go back again, I went, hold on a minute, what are we doing? I can't just bin this off. You know, this is great. We love doing it. Like, we recorded making it and the recipes and sending it to people. I even had one guest, a couple, who had, I think I counted, I think they had about 64 boxes in general. But they made me, they both had teachers, they made me a full printed book, proper, really, really lovely, well done, with all pictures of every single meal occasion that they'd done. They matched cocktails to it, and they got dressed up in bow ties and stuff, and they, you know, I just thought, come on, you can't turn your back on this. So the Isle of Wight's very seasonal, lots of places, West Country, you know, Cornwall places. So when, for example, Christmas, whatever you do, you're going to be less busy here than you are in summer, whatever happens. I want to employ people the entire year round. I don't want to get rid of them out of season. So UB Chef works, we do like a monthly menu now. We do specials like Mother's Day, Easter, Christmas, as long as it works with a delivery day. And we send a almost ready to go meal. You haven't got to start jointing the chicken or, you know, kind of, you know, chopping veg and things. So we'll push it as much as we can where the guest doesn't have to do too much, but they can still, if they want it, they can still pretend to be the chef and shout service to their sous chef and whatever else. The feedback from it is just, it's insane. It's almost like having another restaurant, but that restaurant is the rest of the island and the UK. People will message me about how they thought the food was. They'll send pictures. I've got one guy who actually sends me tracking details of how close, you know, my delivery company is when they get to him. And he's not interested in coming to the restaurant at all. Would never dream of coming to the restaurant. So for me, it's exciting. It's like entrepreneurial, I suppose, but to have that kind of side part to the business where, let's say I might get a chef, a few years' time, someone working for me, they go, Rob, I don't want the late nights anymore. I love cooking, but I just don't want the late nights. I go, okay, sorted. Why don't you do UB Chef? You know, 9-to-5 type job then. You know, because it's all done and dusted and sent out. So I see it as it's another way where I can look after my staff, you know, all year round.
It's clever that, isn't it? Because, I mean, so I received one of your boxes and had a fabulous smoked salmon with smoked salmon mousse and then an amazing piece of chicken. With some utterly delicious potatoes, some highly memorable breads and butters, and an excellent lemon tart. And you know, what was nice about it was, you know, I mean, I've seen a fair number of these recipe boxes over the years. I mean, it's been a kind of a way that, as you rightly say, a lot of the hospitality industry got through COVID. But I think it's interesting how it's evolving. And I think for me, what's really interesting about what you say is it does allow you to play through the complicated seasonality that a place like the Isle of Wight or Cornwall has. And look, you know, you want it, you know, to have the kind of restaurant you want to have, you need to keep your staff busy. And therefore, if there's a way that you can kind of sail through that kind of those down periods with the recipe box, it's a phenomenal way of you know, keeping everyone on board.
Yeah, it is, and it's great fun. It's so much fun doing it sometimes. I mean, if I look back on my phone, the amount of laughs we've had, and serious times, of course, but we've had a lot of fun doing it.
But I think it also comes down to, look, God, back in the day, back in 2011, when we launched Great British Chefs, it was driven by the fact that, you know, one of the things that we knew was that there was an emerging food culture, right, whereby, you know, people wanted to get closer to the kind of the great culinary minds of the UK. And that wasn't the, no disrespect to the kind of food personalities that dominate our airways and continue to do, who have not the culinary training that someone like yourself does. But I think what's interesting about some of these recipe books is it is another way to sort of understand and experience and try things and kind of go, oh, well, maybe I could make a lemon tart. Maybe that's actually not as hard as I think it is. And I think occasionally getting, you know, being able to bring your food into someone's home will inspire and encourage them to try new things.
For sure. I mean, we send like these recipe cards. They're very detailed, pictures and all these things. I take it for granted. Yeah, and I shouldn't do, but you do, because it comes second nature. You live it, you breathe it, of how to plate something up and not spending lots of time. Just do it, put it on a plate, heat it up, done. But for someone at home to do that, and you think they get quite stressed about it, but once, you know, there's certain people who've ordered probably like 4 or 5 times, I suppose then what they say, a lot of them, is they get used to how, they can feel how I've made that recipe up and how I've, you know, said to plate it. Then all of a sudden you'll see their plating, they'll send pictures back and it's bang on. It's exactly as how we've plated it. But then you'll find what the result is, it pushes them into cooking. It pushes them what they expect when they go out, because they go, hold on, I've made that from a box which I've ordered that's come to me. Then they'll go out. So again, you're raising the standards all the time.
Yeah, and your suppliers must also love it, because obviously I'm assuming it means, like, you know, the chicken, for example, that I had, or the salmon, it means that actually in the off season, rather than you becoming a quiet customer, you're still creating demand, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think that helps. If we want this island, which I do, to be more and more sustainable, to have more and more producers, because it could have tons more than what it does currently. Well, the only way that's going to happen is by there being a demand from people to use it. It's all very well opening a restaurant and ordering all from flipping, you know, whatever, to come in frozen. That's not helping the island at all. What you need is people who are going to order, you know, all of, yeah, and in a big way as well. Because if you've got a field of, you know, Cavolo growing, well, where are you going to get rid of it? Yeah, field, you know, it's quite hard in that time of year, because this can really go dead. You know, from, let's say, November, first week of November, usually it drops off an absolute cliff. And a lot of people will shut up, you know, shut up shop. I don't want that. I want consistency for my team. If they've got a family, I don't want them to have to go halfway across the world working on a yacht or whatever it might be.
No, it's great, isn't it? And I think there is one of the kind of the challenges, isn't it? Which is, you know, too often some of these restaurants can sit as little kind of bubbles, right, where they kind of perform at a certain moment in time and then disappear. And actually, you know, a lot of the people I'm speaking to nowadays talk about trying to make sure that the restaurant, the food producers are impacting the local community and inspiring the local community to eat better, but also to be more sustainable. By, if you can make sure that the people who are growing stuff can get money over a longer period, that's really exciting for them.
And that's what I can't wait for here. It's not just elitist. People will be able to come here, and I'm hoping in time I've got a bit of a farm kind of idea coming up in, you know, as well, where we can literally show, this is where we grow it. Like even that salad that comes with the steak, we're going to grow it and it's going to come here, but you're going to be able to get it in a, you know, I say affordable, and a lot of people may gun me down for that, because is 35 quid for a steak affordable? For lots of people it's not. But generally in a pub somewhere, that's what you're paying for something like that. So I just mean that my Robert Thompson kind of brand, if I can offer those kind of dishes, you know, with superb ingredients, cooked by people, you know, real passion, in a place like this, It's exciting.
But I think, you know, I've often talked about the kind of the environmental and economic impact, actually, of having a major restaurant in one of these areas. And actually, the fact is, it does encourage, you know, local farmers to grow more sustainable produce, to grow more specific, more diverse things, rather than just mass monocultural. It does encourage people to actually think about, you know, what they're eating, where they're eating. It encourages businesses to pop up. It encourages, you know, people to come and stay at other places and then come visit your restaurant. It makes it a destination. And I think that's what's exciting about what you're doing. I think, you know, lots of other chefs, you know, the Nathans of this world have done it down, you know, in Cornwall, you know, as, you know, with Rick Stein obviously preceding him. But, you know, there are lots of chefs, Simon Rogan, etc., who've really taken an area and gone, you know what, I'm going to tell a story in this area and I'm going to create a business that is truly going to make an impact to the local environment. I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, and how far it can go, like the potters, even the pottery companies who have been making your plates. It's just amazing how far it can extend out and the amount of people that it can. It's not just food that it affects.
But that requires the imagination, doesn't it? And that's what I think has changed probably in the last 15 years. Is I think that's where people have, you know, if there's one positive that came out of COVID, it's the fact that people kind of began to look to their community, look to the kind of impact they can create, look to alternative business models. And look, the hospitality industry has had a horrible time the last few years. But, you know, it's always inspiring to see stories where people are sort of grabbing the bull by the horns and trying to make something that really has the right impact.
For me, exactly, that rings true. I think I'm just super grateful and thankful as well. I have great people by my side. And also looking back at COVID, things, well, would I have ever done certain things if that didn't happen? UB Chef has completely transformed my life. It's changed so much. I know for lots of people it's really, really tough, and it was tough for members of my team, but for me it wasn't. You know, I was able to keep on the road. I class myself as a lucky one, really. I was on the road. I was busier than ever. So I think it was, for me, a real defining point. And it's great, like, now to talk to, for example, Annie and Jermaine, who have regular, you know, sort of contact with them. I really hope they can come back down and see this. But you look back to mentors like that in your career and you go, this is why you put the hard blooming work in. And it'll all come back. It'll all come back at some point, you know, one day.
Indeed. Well, listen, Robert, thank you so much for taking the time for joining us today. Really appreciate it. And I'm super excited to see and hear how the restaurant unfolds.
Pleasure. Can't wait to welcome you down.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Cheers, Ollie.
Thanks for listening to The Food Talk Show. And if you enjoyed this episode, please do follow us on LinkedIn or subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts.